your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Take another look at me. Dare to go beyond skin deep. Take another look and see I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful. I am so beautiful.
Good afternoon and welcome to Savor Yourself Beyond Skin Deep with your host, Doris Smeltzer. What does it mean to truly love the skin you're in? Keep listening and find out. Now, here's your host, Doris Smeltzer.
Welcome to this week's Savor Yourself Beyond Skin Deep. Last week, we ran out of time, and I wasn't able to ask our guest, Dr. Anita Johnston. She's the author of Eating in the Light of the Moon, and the director of the Anorexia and Bulimia Center of Hawaii. I wasn't able to ask her how she savors herself. So after the show, I wrote to Anita and asked if she'd share with us via email, and she kindly replied. She says, "When I thought about the ways in which I savor myself, I realized that many of the ways I do so are in celebration of my senses. I look at the moon or watch the sunset. I eat rose petal sorbet that I make from the roses in my garden. I listen to soothing music. I dance by myself or with others. I walk by the ocean. I read books with exciting ideas or beautiful words. I pet my animals. I talk with friends." She ends with, "Once I get started listing all the things, I can just keep going. I think that will do for now. Warmest aloha, Anita." Thank you, Anita. And as always, the journey that has brought me to Savor Yourself began when our 19-year-old daughter, Andrea, died of bulimia 8 years ago. Andrea is an integral part of the show's purpose. So each segment begins and ends with her words. The journal entry that I've chosen today was written when Andrea was 17, and it was 1 week before high school graduation. One of the other high schools in town had suffered a tragedy during a senior outing to a water park here in Northern California. One of the water slides gave way, and students fell from great heights. One young woman lost her life. In a journal entry made that day, Andrea reflected on her learnings from this horrific event. She wrote, "I know that one day, not too far from now, it will seem long past, but I write this now so I won't ever allow myself to forget the lesson. Life is precious. It is over faster than we can blink. We are never invincible. Truth is not eternal, and human memory is as short as human life. I want to have this ingrained on my soul so that I remember that all my life's moments are important and worth my full, wholehearted partaking." Today's guest is Dr. Deb Burghardt. She's an amazing psychologist and eating disorders specialist in private practice in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's the creator of the award-winning body image website, bodypositive.com, and the co-author of Great Shape, the first fitness guide for large women. Dr. Burghardt is one of the founding proponents of the Health at Every Size approach to weight concerns, which is a refreshing paradigm shift that focuses not on weight, but on total health and well-being. Deb is going to help us take up occupancy inside our own skin. Now, I need to give you a warning that she has been suffering with a bad cough for the last few weeks, but she was still willing to be with us today. Deb, welcome.
Thank you, Doris.
And I promised her I would not make her laugh.
Well, here we go. We're off to a great start.
So, Deb, you need to tell us, what is Health at Every Size?
Well, the main thing that's different about Health at Every Size is that it's a focus on a person's quality of life and well-being as opposed to their weight. And so we look at the practices that people do, just like what you're looking at with Savor Yourself, the kinds of everyday practices that people can do for themselves and for each other, which really bring about feelings of social support and being comfortable in your body and feeding yourself well, getting enough rest, you know, things that are really empirically demonstrated to improve the quality of people's lives and also to improve their longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a kind of answer that a lot of healthcare professionals and also size acceptance activists have kind of formed together to answer the deficits of the more traditional model that focuses on weight loss as the panacea for just about everything.
Isn't that the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And we're told if we just lose a few pounds,
mm-hmm.
life would be good.
Right, and people load up that fantasy of being thinner with everything that they can possibly think of that they desire. They load it up with their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of magical thinking that people do with that. And, you know, it's part of what fuels people's eating disorders, and it's also something that is there for people across the you know, eating disorder spectrum or the weight spectrum. You know, people who have no clinical eating disorders often really are suffering as well because they keep putting off their lives. They keep thinking that, you know, something has to wait until they're a particular size, or they have to wait to feel worthy of being good to themselves in order to behave in a way that's good to themselves. But the problem with that, of course, is that in the meantime, you are behaving in some way that you're interpreting all the time. And so if you're neglecting things or postponing things, you're going to feel neglected and you're going to feel unworthy, and so your feelings about yourself aren't going to change.
Right.
And so we really talk about having a commitment to behave towards yourself in a way that honors yourself, whether you feel like you deserve it or not right now, because part of what's going to help you feel like you deserve it is to do those practices.
Yes. That's so true. It's a practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be done every single day, even if we're not feeling worthy, because we have to maintain that idea, I think, constantly. Actually, I am worthy. I'm worthy today,
mm-hmm.
the way I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But we're constantly being bombarded with claims of an obesity epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
How does Health at Every Size respond to those claims?
Well, a lot of us are academics, and some of us are researchers, and some of us are healthcare providers, and some of us are activists, some of us are artists. There's a lot of people who are kind of bringing their intelligence and wisdom to bear on this issue. And when you analyze the claims from a statistical point of view, a lot of the research that is reported in the news is reported in a way that isn't very helpful. It doesn't help people think critically about what methods were used to come to these conclusions. And there's so much, there's so many meanings that are associated with body size in our Western culture that what happens is a lot of this sort of gets merged together in an uncritical way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a kind of panic.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have called it a moral panic around the ideas about what fatness means. And it really does influence some of the reporting of the research, and it influences even some of the science that's chosen to be done or not chosen to be done. So we're looking at all of that, and we're trying to critique that. And one of the main obvious things that comes up is that fat isn't healthy. And, you know, what we're trying to say is that people who are healthy come in all different sizes. People who are not healthy come in all different sizes. And that body mass index is a pretty bad proxy for health, even though it's easy to measure, and which is sort of, I think, a lot of the dependency on that, really can't take the place of getting to know someone and what they're doing in their lives and what their genetics are doing with that set of practices. So there's a lot of confounding variables in the research that are very expensive to kind of take apart and do well. So you have a lot of short-term studies that are pretty much like scientific versions of before and after shots, you know, that are not very interesting because after the after shot,
right,
people return to their baseline weight or even gain weight back. You have, you know, big population studies that imply that being at a heavier weight is not as healthy, that fail to look at other potential reasons for that finding. One of the biggest one is class. Socioeconomic status is not that hard of a thing to control for, but if you notice, the research in the last 15 or 20 years has almost totally dropped it out as one of the controls for the findings, which is really too bad because body mass index varies with class. And so everything that is going to be a problem because you have less money or you live in a more polluted place or you don't have as much access to health care, to quality health care, or you live under stress, all of those things are going to be confounded with weight because people weigh more who have less money. And then you have, of course, the issue of physical activity, which is rarely looked at in the research, that's kind of hard to measure. But when you do measure that and you kind of look at how much of the effects of health can be explained by a physical activity or a lack of physical activity, it always changes the numbers. And so that's a very powerful confounding factor that's almost always in there to some degree. And, you know, weight cycling itself is a big probable cause of some health problems. We know that if you lose weight and gain it back, we've known from rat studies that you can induce hypertension in animals by having their weight cycle. And so all these things that people are trying to do to become more healthy, and when they don't work, they return to their baseline, are probably making them physically less healthy. And of course, the bigger sort of overarching problem is how much stigma is attached to being at a heavier weight. Living under any kind of stigma is not good for your health.
Absolutely. It makes so much sense. Oh, there we are. What perfect timing. We're going to go to break, and we'll return with more from Dr. Deb Burkhardt.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Savor yourself. Get more information on eating disorders and body image issues at andreasvoice.org. To purchase Doris's critically acclaimed book, Andrea's Voice, Silenced by Bulimia, go to andreasvoice.org, the GERS Books website at bulimia.com, or any bookstore.
Hey, how you doing? Educational videos, top quality, right here.
You'll never hear anyone selling education on the street.
Yo, what's up, baby? Want to learn some history?
I got live learning, beautiful books inside.
And don't expect anyone to just offer you an education.
Who needs a high school diploma, huh?
And fortunately, you can't buy a diploma from some guy with a briefcase. But there is one way you can get the educational skills you and your family need for free, with free family learning programs. Call 1-877-FAMLIT-1 for information on free GED, computer training classes, and other family learning programs. That's 1-877-FAMLIT-1.
Check it out. You want your GED right here, guaranteed, ma. Come on, check it out.
After all, you can't get your education on the street. free family learning programs from the National Center for Family Literacy, the first step to a better life. Brought to you by the National Center for Family Literacy and the Ad Council.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Take another look and see I'm beautiful. Beautiful is me.
Welcome back to Savor Yourself Beyond Skin Deep with host Doris Smeltzer. If you have a question or comment for Doris, write to her at doris@savoryourself.org. Now back to today's show.
We are back with Dr. Deb Burgard, author, presenter, and therapist specializing in eating disorders. And right before the break, Deb was kind of giving us an overview of the claims about obesity epidemic and all of the factors that play into that. Deb, I'd like you to talk a little bit now about the lack of intervention.
Yeah, that's one of the main things that has sort of produced the health at every size model. It's kind of, you know, necessity is the mother of invention.
Indeed.
I think a lot of us who have been in healthcare have watched our patients struggle with attempting to choose their weight or lose weight, or certainly the people, those of us that have worked with eating disorders, can are very intimately aware of this sort of mythology of, you know, people trying to choose the number on the scale and the sort of devastation that that can lead to. And so I think what we're building on here are all of, is sort of the all of the evidence that we don't really have very good interventions to change people's weight anyway. So the whole notion that the conventional approach is built on, that you pick the number on the scale and then you do whatever it takes to get there, and that's your healthy weight, is really kind of nonsensical from the point of view of not really having a way to do that. And so what you end up seeing is that people do all kinds of crazy things to get to a particular number on the scale, and it's not healthy what they do to get there, and that is probably not their healthy weight. So what we look at with Health at Every Size is we try to help people calm down about this enough that they can actually focus on doing the right things in their lives for them. So whatever is a sustainable way of feeding themselves, or whatever is a sustainable way of getting some pleasurable physical activity, you know, whatever is sustainable for them for the rest of their lives, in terms of self-care, that's going to take time to establish. And then once that is sort of your daily practice, your genetic heritage is going to translate that set of practices into a particular body size. That's what we consider your healthy weight, because we can't come up with any better definition of your healthy weight except for that sort of operational definition, the weight that you are when you're living in a healthy way. And so we're trying to combat the message that you should do whatever it takes to conform to some chart on the wall, which is not going to be applicable to you as an individual.
Right. And while you do that, though, I think you're in direct opposition with the culture, because here's a person saying, well, I eat well, I exercise, I'm living healthy, but how can I be satisfied with this body that you're telling me is my natural and healthy weight when the culture tells me this body's not acceptable because it's larger than what they say?
Right, and that is the boat that almost everybody is in.
Yes.
Because if we look at the population, you know, as a whole, and you have a nice bell curve, you know, for most biological traits, and you have a bell curve for weight, and you take that little tail on the left, which is just a tiny minority of the population who are sort of naturally thin when they're, you know, just eating whatever and, you know, they're living their lives well. And those are the people who are presumed to be kind of the chosen ones.
Yes.
Now, some some of those people are not necessarily, you know, treating themselves very well at all, but, you know, we look at people's body size and work backwards. That's what Health at Every Size is trying to combat. So here's the whole rest of the population who really would prefer to be thinner in order to have the social power and the privilege that comes from being thinner, in order to avoid the medical lectures when they go to the doctor, or to, you know, not have the family kind of go, oh, you have to lose weight whenever they see you, you know. All of these things are very legitimate things to wish for. But what we're trying to say here is that that's going to have to change by changing people's understanding of this, because it's not going to change because some, you know, two-digit number on the scale is available to you as a weight. And for some people, their healthy weights are going to be well above what people consider to be, you know, even average. I mean, there are people who are going to be fat.
Sure.
And they're going to be fat because that's what their body's genetics translate a healthy lifestyle into. Now, this is one of the most skeptical kinds of points about the whole thing, because we hang on so tightly to the idea that, you know, if you get all of this straightened out in your practices, and if you you know, perform the right rituals around food, and you perform the right rituals in the gym, and if you you know, and if you are good to the gods, that, you know, you will magically be able to be the weight that you have chosen. And it's not true. So we do have to work with people, and of course in my profession I'm working with people on body image issues all the time. And cherishing our bodies is a really tough thing, no matter what body size you are. It's a fascinating thing to me, because it seems so strange that we don't honor our bodies more when we're so dependent on them.
We sure are.
You know, wherever we were before we got born, and wherever we're going after we die, for the time being,
you know, this is the vehicle.
We are completely dependent on these bodies, and they're very, very precious. And they allow us, like Dr. Johnson was saying in the quote at the beginning, they allow us to experience so much pleasure. They allow us to—they're just everything to us. And you know, there's so much negative adversarial energy that we kind of build into our relationships with our bodies, and it's just such a tragedy to me.
It is. It breaks my heart. I can't tell you how often I hear from parents, and specifically moms, just because moms usually write me more than dads do, and they say, they express dismay because their daughter or son has developed an eating disorder, and they go, you know, I really don't know what happened, because he or she dieted properly, and then all of a sudden this eating disorder started.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it wasn't until after Andrea died and I entered the eating disorder world that I finally learned that dieting is actually considered the gateway drug to an eating disorder. And yet that certainly isn't common knowledge. We just so accept the idea that dieting is okay.
Well, you know, it's certainly something that people who have the genes to develop an eating disorder, you know, really need to stay away from, you know, in the sense that those people are going to be particularly vulnerable, and doing this is not going to be you know, a benign process for them. But even if you don't have a kind of underlying vulnerability to eating disorders, the whole practice of learning how to diet is really a whole tutorial in how to ignore your body.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that seems like exactly the wrong process if you're trying to live in a healthy way. I mean, it would be sort of like if you showed your self-control in our culture by only peeing, you know, one time a day.
Right. Oh, ouch.
You know, and, you know, you sort of said, well, you know, we would have, you know, plenty of peeing disorders, and we'd have peeing disorder treatment centers.
You know? Oh, we would have a lot of kidney infections.
You know, and it's really just this very straightforward biological thing that our bodies regulate quite well for most people. And when you stop paying attention to your body as a partner in making those choices, then you lose the most kind of moderating influence that you have, you know, and it becomes a more psychologically based thing, which is what we're being told, is that we have to use our minds to police our bodies. But let me tell you, psychologist, our minds are like way more out of control around certain processes than our bodies are, you know.
Oh, gosh.
So, you know, it's really, you think about bodies, they don't like to be uncomfortable, you know, and bodies don't like to go for a really long time being hungry, and bodies don't like to get too full. And that's wonderful, because that means that if you're really working with your body, you're going to eat in a fairly moderate way, because that's how bodies are comfortable.
So let's say right now I'm a parent who's listening, and prior to hearing your incredible words, I've subscribed to the mainstream messages about food, weight, and size. Now, I really am thinking this sounds like it makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. So in what ways would my parenting change if I wanted to begin today with a health at every size approach with my children?
Well, one of the things that I would love to see is more of an active kind of tutoring of your child in how to use his or her body cues to make some of these decisions. And not just for food, but for everything. I mean, if you started at the very beginning, well, let me put it this way. When your infant is born, your infant does not need to be taught how to know she is hungry. And your infant doesn't need to be taught to know when she's satisfied. And every person who's fed an infant will tell you, oh, yeah. They told me, you know, she told me in no uncertain terms she was hungry. And then she told me in no uncertain terms she was done. I mean,
exactly.
I couldn't get her to eat more. She's looking around, you know, she's looking around the room. I couldn't get her to, you know. And if we respect those cues that our child has and we don't train them out of those cues, we have done a great deal for that child just right off the bat. And so as that child is getting older and can speak and can understand some of these things, you can orient them towards what's going on in their tummy. And you can orient them towards what kinds of things happen when they eat different kinds of food, you know, because there's going to be different sort of consequences half an hour later, 2 hours later, 3 hours later. And this is what I do with patients as well. You know, we look at kind of the whole process of eating from the time that you're enjoying the flavor or not enjoying the flavor of what's in your mouth all the way through digestion and that food becoming a part of you. And there's, you know, there's a way to kind of try to make that whole experience as pleasant an experience as possible from the flavor all the way through the digestion process. And different foods are going to matter. They're going to be different kinds of fuel for different kinds of bodies. Where, you know, some of us have descended from Maasai warriors and, you know, we eat cow protein, and that's really what our bodies are meant to do. And some of us have, you know, grown up with nuts and grains and things that are, you know, much, much less intense proteins.
Indeed. Stay tuned for more with Deb Burghardt. We'll be back.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Savor yourself. Get more information on eating disorders and body image issues at andreasvoice.org. To purchase Doris's critically acclaimed book, Andrea's Voice, Silenced by Bulimia, go to andreasvoice.org, the GERS Books website at bulimia.com, or any bookstore.
Would it be crazy if you just stopped everything, packed your bags and left for a week, a month, a year? What if you left for 2 years? Would people think you'd lost your mind? What if you were going far away to help in a village on the edge of the Gobi Desert? A village crowded with Buddhist temples, not skyscrapers. A place where there isn't a word for recluse, but 1,000 words for community. Would it be crazy to go 5,000 miles from home to spend time with people the rest of the world only reads about? to build libraries and fill them with stories, prepare a meal with food you helped grow, to teach children and learn a thing or two about yourself. Would that be crazy? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Take another look and see I'm beautiful. Beautiful is me.
Welcome back to Savor Yourself Beyond Skin Deep with host Doris Smeltzer. If you have a question or comment for Doris, write to her at doris@savoryourself.org. Now back to today's show.
We are talking to Deb Burgard, therapist and author, who is sharing a radical new way of being in the world. And I call it radical because it really is. It's that, the difference in the paradigm between this and what our culture usually gives us. It's just radically different, isn't it, Deb?
Mm-hmm.
Now, before the break, we were talking about how my parenting might look different if mm-hmm. I took a health at every size approach starting today. You mentioned in your answer, you said, if we don't train our children out of their cues, mm-hmm. and it occurred to me that parents may not know, well, in what ways might I train my child out of listening to their body?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the best divisions of responsibility, let's say, between the parent and the child has been articulated by another therapist whose name is Ellen Satter. And mm-hmm. she talks about, with this sort of establishment of a relationship of feeding, it's competent, you know, like you're trying to teach your child to be a competent feeder,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying not to undermine the sort of basic skills that they already have when they arrive. And so you're going to have certain things that you have to do as a parent, like schedule meals, because you can't have food available all the time in every possible variety. You know, that's not very practical. But allowing the child to tell you, you know, when they're hungry, when they're full, how much they want to eat, whether they want to eat at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are things that really can be left up to your child. And I would add that closing the feedback loops, you know, as a child grows and is more and more capable of sort of seeing the consequences of their decision making, it's very powerful to kind of circle back to, you know, parents do this all the time, but circle back to these particular issues, like, you know, today you're feeling really, you know, irritable, you know, because you had this kind of, maybe it has something to do with what you had for lunch, you know, you didn't really, you know, get satisfied. You know, this is something that you can do with sleep, certainly. You know, you're helping your child kind of develop some structures for themselves, but you're also helping them understand why. You know, why is it that you want to have, you know, a bedtime that's not 3 a.m? You know,
mm-hmm.
why is it that you want to make sure that your body has fuel that's your body's best fuel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that you can, you know, use in their actual experience and staying really close to their experience and then looping it back to, wow, that was the decision that you made and here's some good information. Now you've done that experiment. Now when you're making the choice the next time, you might want to try this experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really help that child know themselves. You have confidence in their ability to know themselves and develop that capacity. You know, I think it's one of the most powerful things that parents can give as a message to their children, that they really can trust themselves. You know, that the parents aren't the source of all the information, that the child has a tremendous amount of information that the parents are going to rely on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the parents don't have any way to go to the bathroom for their kid.
Right.
You know, you have to go to the bathroom. You know, you have
right.
to be the one who knows when you have to go. And it's great. It's a partnership. And, you know, it's a kind of parenting that really, I think, develops a capacity in a child to trust themselves. Now, this is something that can be a pebble in a pond. You know, you teach your child to pay attention to their hunger and satiety. You teach them to pay attention to how tired they are or other things that are needs that they're having physically or things that they're feeling in their body. And they can start looking to their body sensations for all kinds of data.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're uncomfortable with a particular situation or if they feel like they want to say something and they're not able to speak up about something or if they're being asked to do something that's really making them uncomfortable, they're going to feel all those things in their bodies. And, you know, it seems to me that our health education could be oriented around this approach, and it would be wildly different from
it
the messages that we have now that are sort of nagging messages coming from some external source that kids have no reason to trust because they're not experiencing what the person is telling them.
It would also, I mean, I love that it empowers the individual, but it allows also for the individual to tease apart what really is going on so that then they can start to see then feel the difference between physical and emotional hunger and those kinds of things. Now,
it's a completely different sort of relationship with your child. I mean, you're sort of watching your child's wisdom unfold about themselves, which is, I think, very reassuring.
It certainly is.
I mean, I certainly feel that way about working with patients. I don't think it's something that's in me that's going on in this process. I think it's something that's going on in them that is inherent in them.
Mm-hmm.
And all I have to do is help them get the stuff out of the way of that process. I don't have to make them do anything. They want to do it.
Sure. And also acknowledge when they are doing it so that they know, this is what you mean.
Right. Exactly.
The valuable information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during break, you and I were talking about this is all well and good, but as a parent, if my child is considered, and I'm going to put this in large quotation marks, overweight, I'm judged.
Mm-hmm.
If my child develops an eating disorder, I'm judged.
Right.
It must be. These things must be the parent's fault.
Right. Right. And this is a sort of weird parallel process to what the child may be going through, too, in being judged for being fat, you know, or being judged. They feel judged for not being thin enough, you know. And so it's sort of a human endeavor for all of us to figure out how to stand by what is true for us in the face of other people's stereotypes, in the face of their judgments, to, as a parent, as an adult, be able to say, well, I know what's going on in my household, and I know what's going on with my child, and I have to stand by that. And I will try to make that show up as much as I can. And you do that, and then your child sees you doing that, and your child can sort of see, here's what it looks like when someone is encountering judgment or prejudice, and there are some skills that are useful in that situation. One of the best skills is to try to keep showing up through the fog of the stereotype. So, you know, you are charming, you are smart, you are loyal, you are creative, you know, all the things that you are, you know, those are the things that you want to find a way to express to somebody who's not giving you much of a chance. And, you know, all of us need those skills, and we need them for our entire lives because there's going to be different stereotypes that we, you know, provoke in other people no matter what, no matter whether we're thin and blonde and look like Barbie or whether we are fat and bookish and with glasses or, you know, old or wrinkling or, you know, anything. You know, you're going to keep dealing with this question of stereotyping for your whole life. And it's another opportunity, I think, for everybody to kind of bring forward the truth of their own experiences.
Yes, it's really hard, I think, as a parent, to show our children, this is who I am,
mm-hmm.
and this is how I am in the world,
mm-hmm.
and I don't need to make excuses for it.
Right. Right. I mean, and this is another thing I would tell parents in terms of raising resilient children, you know, not just the practical part of the eating stuff, but, you know, express admiration for people based on some other criteria, you know. Show what your values are to your children. You know, when people are doing things that conform to those values, that are expressions of a life well lived, you know, this is wisdom that you're going to pass on to your child, and it's the most important kind of wisdom. And, you know, I also, when fathers ask me about, you know, how do I make sure that my kid doesn't have an eating disorder,
mm-hmm.
you know, lots of times I'll say, well, you know, for fathers, make sure that you express admiration and respect for your wife in
mm-hmm.
front of your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think an awful lot of girls are afraid of growing to be an adult woman and being made fun of for having that adult woman's body, and sort of crossing over into a world where they're going to be discriminated against because of that, you know?
Yeah.
So having the role model of, you know, understanding that it's quite possible for an adult woman who has fat on her body to be well-loved and well-respected and admired even is an important concern, I think, of a lot of girls.
I think that listening to a father and hearing him make comments about other women,
mm-hmm.
women on the street, let's
mm-hmm.
say a very large woman walks by, imagine the difference between, oh my, she looks awful in that. Look at how fat she is.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the way she walks.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel her confidence.
Mm-hmm.
She has amazing presence.
Right.
What a difference.
Mm-hmm. Because I think you give your child the sort of sense of possibilities, which are real. You know, like people say, oh, that's just pie in the sky. I don't think it is at all. I mean, I'm somebody who, you know, wasn't going to look like the average, but I wasn't going to look like the pretty girl growing up. I knew that. And I had to figure out how to have other kinds of social power. And I developed my other ways of being socially powerful. And I think those are ways that have served me. You know, I'm 50 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not worried about Botox.
What a relief.
I'm not worried about a facelift. I'm really not losing my social power because I didn't build it on looks. I built it on what's inside of me, my skills, what I have to offer the world, you know, my presence, my joy at different experiences, you know, my wish to help people. These are things which don't change as we age.
Oh, and that's a beautiful way for us to go to break. Don't go away.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure, what's up?
There's this girl I kind of like.
Well, if there's one thing I know, it's women.
Really?
Well, they didn't call me Velvet for nothing.
I don't get it.
Smooth. I was smooth.
Oh.
Anyway, it's easy. You just got to impress her. Show her how strong you are.
Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
I don't know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt, if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, ugh! Try it.
Ugh!
See, there you go. And you should dress up. Start wearing a shirt and tie.
I'll look like a dork.
No, you'll look successful.
Okay.
And finally, you can start using my cologne. The ladies love it, so don't be shy. Splash it on.
Thanks, Dad.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Savor yourself. Get more information on eating disorders and body image issues at AndreasVoice.org. To purchase Doris's critically acclaimed book, Andrea's Voice, Silenced by Bulimia, go to AndreasVoice.org, the GERS Books website at bulimia.com, or any bookstore.
Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell. They say it's from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote. And then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found a small patch of plastic on my right shoulder.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Real Life Solutions. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Take another look and see. I'm beautiful.
Welcome back to Savor Yourself, Beyond Skin Deep, with host Doris Smeltzer. If you have a question or comment for Doris, write to her at doris@savoryourself.org. Now back to today's show.
We are back with the phenomenal author and therapist, Dr. Deb Burgard. And before the break, Deb, you were talking about how because you have your social power is not based on looks, simply because of what you've developed, as you age, you don't suffer in the ways that so many others do in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And during the break, we were talking about how sometimes with, at least for me, sometimes when I'm with my friends and if they make disparaging remarks about their own body, I have to say, do you remember who you're with?
That's
and,
right.
And can we talk?
That's right.
So
that led to my, I have a little door hanger on the body positive website.
Oh, I love that. That's hanging here in my house.
It has a little, you know, red circle with a line through it, through the statement, I'm so fat. And it says, entering body disparagement free zone. So people can put it, you know, wherever they need to so that they can kind of get away from this sort of secondhand smoke of that fat talk, you know, I'm so fat, I'm so fat. Because it really is hard to watch someone doing that to themselves, and it's also hard to be around, and it sort of, you know, kind of stimulates everybody's tapes within themselves. And so, you know, I think that's right, that we need to help each other to refocus what we're expressing. And, you know, what are we expressing? You know, if we couldn't say, you know, oh, I'm so fat, what would you be saying?
Yes.
You know, would you be saying, I'm really anxious because, you know, I'm feeling like I'm losing some of my power to be attractive? Or, you know, would people be saying I'm afraid that people won't think I'm lovable? Or would people be saying I'm worried about death?
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
All of us have to worry about, you know, not getting out of here alive, you know, and we don't really talk about it. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we might be able to talk about more directly and more in a more satisfying way. So we need to help each other do that. And, you know, you're raising the issue of people greeting each other.
Yes.
Oh, you look so great. You've lost weight. You know, how do you kind of get away from those things? And, you know, one of the people on another listserv, Kathy Miller, wrote a wonderful post about becoming a spirit admirer, and sort of cultivating a capacity within herself to really look for, you know, people's spirits and presences, and to express admiration, you know, when she's seeing somebody's spirit emerge, you know, when they're sort of being more themselves, you know, their job on the planet is to be as much themselves as possible. And so, you know, when you see somebody who's sort of, you know, taking a little risk and doing that, you know, you really celebrate that. And so being able to, you know, respond to that in people or saying, you know, that they do look peaceful or they look calm or they look excited about something or, you know, that's a certain kind of loveliness. You know, mm-hmm. You can certainly tell someone they look lovely with those attributes showing. And I think the more you practice that, the better you get at it. And also the more people feel actually witnessed accurately by you, which is a wonderful gift that we can give each other.
To be seen.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I say when I'm greeting someone is it's good to see you.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
And it states the reality for me, and it has nothing to do with their physical appearance.
Yeah.
Nothing at all.
Exactly.
I sometimes wonder, what would we talk about if we didn't have dieting?
Yeah. Well, you know, the world is really in dire straits. I think there's plenty to talk about. I really do. I cannot wait for this to sort of fade away in importance. I don't know if I'm going to see it in my lifetime or not, but I just think about all of the energy that can be, you know, kind of put to some other use, and all the money and all the time and all the preoccupation. I know it's going to be, to the people who are living in that world, it will not seem like a big deal because it'll just be like some chainsaw sound that stops, you know. You know, you just kind of think, oh, okay. And you move on with your life and you don't say, oh, God, I love this lack of a chainsaw. I love it, I love it. You know, it just feels so good that it's not there anymore. And it feels so normal that it's not there anymore. And our attentions will be shifted to whatever they need to go to. So I don't think it's necessarily going to be a utopia because
no. There
are plenty of things that we need to kind of grapple with and tackle, but it just seems like, you know, a colossal waste. And it's, you know, we don't really have a lot of resources to waste. We have some pretty big things that we need to figure out and quickly.
We sure do. Now, you kind of addressed this already because you talked about focus. Where do we get our personal power?
Mm-hmm.
But why do women find it so hard to savor themselves?
Well, I think there's a stigma around self-focused activities. I think for a lot of women, especially parents, women who are mothers, there's this training that you sort of give to yourself of putting the people who you care for first and putting yourself back into that equation as at least equal to those other people is a difficult thing. It's not really very well supported, and people do judge each other on, you know, not being selfless enough. But it really makes the capacity that you have to care for other people even deeper when you are showing yourself that you are worth caring about. And what's also really important, I think, is that your children are watching. Your children are watching how you treat yourself, and they will watch the actions more than they will listen to your words.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want them to be able to do it, you have to be able to do it yourself if you can, as much as you can. And so it's another struggle to kind of go against the currents of what a good person is supposed to look like. You have to challenge all of these received ideas about what it means to be a good person and a good woman and a good mother.
Mm-hmm. And so often in the culture, we feel that I am good if I look good.
Right.
And so when we equate those two, it's a no-win situation.
It is, and we have to help each other look deeper, that these little incidental encounters that we're settling for are not a life. You know, glancing at each other as we're walking by, you know, oh, what a hottie. Oh, well, you know.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
No, it is not. So, Deb, in your personal life, in what are the ways that you savor yourself?
You know, I had such luck with having parents, the parents that I did. They were tremendously gifted in some ways, and they did help me really trust myself. So I hear things inside of myself that are encouraging words a lot, which I sort of laugh at sometimes because I think, oh, that was really good, or that was really smart, or good job on that. You know, like I actually hear myself saying those things.
Oh, dear, we're just about out of time. Thank you, Deb.
You're welcome.
It has been such a joy. And I look forward to next week. Our next guest is Kenyon College professor, Dr. Michael Levine. And let us close with Andrea's words, where she remembers that all of my life's moments are important and worth my full, wholehearted partaking. Until next week, may you partake in all your life's moments fully as you remember to savor yourself.
Take another look and see I'm beautiful. Beautiful is me.
We appreciate you spending this hour with Doris Smeltzer and Savor Yourself. If you would like to learn more about eating disorder prevention, visit our site at andreasvoice.org. That's andreasvoice.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more valuable tips on how to dare to go beyond skin deep and to truly savor yourself. We'll see you next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific, right here on the Health and Wellness Channel.